Good morning, members. Sorry about the delay. We were trying to get the tape going there. I think we've got it on. Is that right? Okay. Good morning, and Representative Carlson and I, this is a joint meeting of the Tax Committee and the Finance Committee, and we welcome everyone who's here today. Just a few preliminary comments, but I just heard coming in that the governor is having a press conference with the governor of Wisconsin at 11, and so I know a lot of people are interested in that too, so I anticipate the room will be kind of busy as people are trying to do multiple things at once, and we understand that and expect that, and we're going to have a premium on chairs, so feel free to fill in on other people's name tags and take a spot as people come and go. So again, welcome, and I just want to just preliminary thank the folks who are here who did this work for us. This is the Minnesota Budget Trends Study Commission report, and members can look in their packets to see the copy of the bill that created this report, and that's House Bill 2260. I was the House author, and Senator Cohen was the Senate author. And you may not remember, but you all had the chance, you all voted for this as it came out of the omnibus bill process in 2007. Okay, so this bill passed in 2007. The commission's been working hard for all of us for about a year and a half. And, of course, without compensation, just with their minds. And they're a very esteemed group, and we are delighted that they've got the report for us now. What we'd like to do is Representative Carlson has some comments. We want to hear the report, but we want to encourage questions. We want to have you interrupt them as we go so we can address questions that people have immediately. I would like to just say I've asked the co-chairs, Jay Kordowski and Kevin Goodnow, to go through the membership for folks who do not know who was on this group. These were five people appointed by the governor, five by the Speaker, and five by the Senate Majority Leader. And I just, on a very personal note, want to tell you that one of them was a very dear friend of mine and a very dear friend of many of you. And Representative Murphy gave a beautiful memorial to him on the House floor yesterday. And that is my former professor when I was in graduate school, John Brandel, who served on this commission and passed away before its completion. And we all of us who knew him knew what a bright mind he had, and he's dearly missed. So that is one commission member who's no longer with us. But with that, if Representative Carlson, I think Representative Carlson can provide some context for some of these folks.
Well, I wasn't going to go through the list. I just was going to comment that as I look at the commission members, there were many that I've worked with one way or another, either when they were a commissioner of finance or served as some of them you served with as well. When you mentioned Dr. John Brandel, to put something in context there that some forget, they remember Senator John Brandel and his time as a professor, but as was pointed out on the House floor yesterday during the eulogy, he also at one point was a member of the Minnesota House. And actually, I can remember him prior to that even coming over and testifying on various issues relative to budgets and so on here before the legislature with his university hat on. So at any rate, I just want to welcome and thank those that served on the commission, and I suspect we should jump into the testimony.
Thank you. And please begin. And again, members, questions, lots of questions as we go, but some recognition of who actually served first, I guess. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, thank you for inviting us to appear before you. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm a co-chair of the Budget Trends Study Commission. And with me today is
Jay Kondrowski, a senior fellow at the Humphrey Institute.
And Jay, did you want to go
through? Yeah, let me go through the list of people. You know Kevin and I. John Brandel, we just talked about.
Can I just interrupt you? Excuse me. You didn't tell this everybody, though, who you two are. So a lot of people don't know what roles you've served here in state government in the past.
Going way back, I started my career serving as a staff for the Minnesota Senate. I was the budget director for the city of Minneapolis for 5 years in the late 70s, early 80s, and then I became the deputy commissioner, ultimately the commissioner of finance, under Governor Rudy Perfitch through 1987. Spent 17 years in the private sector working for Wells Fargo, running a number of national businesses, And 4 years ago, I retired and joined the Humphrey Institute as a senior fellow specializing in public finance and organizational development.
Thank you.
And I served 12 years in the Minnesota House of Representatives, both on the tax committee for 4 years and also 4 years as the committee chair of a finance committee. So I was able to do the tax side and also knew how to spend the money as well. Then I served almost 4 years under Governor Plenty as Commissioner of Human Services, and now I'm doing other work. And if, when people ask me what I've done, I'm just what I do now, I just say I'm a recovering bureaucrat and politician. So.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Going down the list, Glenn Dorfman, I think numbers of you know him, a former lobbyist, a very astute gentleman. He
very quiet and withdrawn.
Yeah, quiet and withdrawn. He was our most... he wanted to make sure we said something loudly to the legislature. So, Jenny Eng, former Revenue Department commissioner.
Deputy Commissioner.
John Gunyu, former Finance Commissioner for the state of Minnesota under Arne Carlson, currently the City Manager of the City of Minnetonka. Peggy Ingeson, also a former Finance Commissioner under Governor Plenty. She's now the Chief Financial Officer for the Minneapolis Schools. Laura Kalamkidis is a Professor of Public Finance in the Applied Economics Department of the University of Minnesota. Jim Knobloch, a former legislator who's now a business person. Harold Lofgren has retired. He was formerly a professor of public finance at Minnesota University of St. Cloud. Martha Myers,
former state senator, and I think now enjoying retirement as well.
Yeah.
And then known as Robertson, I believe.
Right, that's correct.
So former Senator Martha Robertson. Yeah.
Art Rolnick, the research director for the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. Stephen Ruggles, a professor in population studies and demography at the University of Minnesota. Donald Schumacher, appointment of the governor, a businessman from the St. Cloud area. And Pam Wheelock, who just last week began her, this week began her job as the vice president of the Bush Foundation, a former finance commissioner under Governor Ventura.
Great, thank you. So I think it helps members understand what a very diverse and esteemed group this is, from multiple administrations in all parties, people both in the private sector and who've been here with us. So I think that helps set the context for people who are following this, but this is quite a group of people who, and we thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, we'll start on, and we talked about the charge of the commission. We were established in 2007 as the chair had mentioned previously. To look at the long-term stability of the state budget conditions, including revenue volatility, trend growth rates, current spending pressures, long-term revenue forecasts, and projected expenditures. The group met, we had 14 meetings over almost a year and a half. As the chair mentioned, there's 15 members, 5 appointed from the Senate, 5 from the House, and 5 by the governor. We started off by looking at previous reports that were done with regard to these issues. And we went back 30 years to look at the various reports that had been completed, commission reports, and other recommendations that had been made. We didn't want to start from scratch. We wanted to look at the good work that our predecessors had done. After reviewing those reports, we heard from a number of experts in various areas, including education, revenue, human services, and other various demography, to determine what to get as much background as we could in order to make the decisions and make recommendations that followed. We ended up coming up with and identifying 14 findings, and then out of those findings we identified a number of recommendations that fell into 3 broad categories. At this point, I'm going to run through the findings rather quickly. As the chair suggested, feel free to ask questions if you have, and we'll do our best job to answer them. A lot of these, again, are based off of our findings and the information that we received from the overview that we received from the various experts. The number one finding is that Minnesota is currently experiencing a major long-range demographic shift. Do you want to talk about the chart screen?
Yeah, you can see from the chart that we baby boomers have dominated the population for our lifetime, and we're going to again dominate. Unfortunately, we're aging, and the peak of the baby boom is a couple of years away from retirement, away from 65, As we look out over the next 20, 25 years, that group is going to become a cost burden on the state and not providing the tax revenues it once did.
In addition, just please note that we also have the increasing demographic at the youngest ages as well. So we have the pressure on both the top end of the age bracket and the bottom end, and where we're seeing a decline are the people that typically we rely on for income and revenue generation. The number, the next demographic finding is that Minnesota has become more diverse in recent years, and this will continue to increase as economic growth depends on drawing new workers to the state.
Mm-hmm. You can see from the chart that Minnesota in 1990 had 6% diversity. We're now up to 14%, and as the demographer looked out in the future, suggested that that was going to be increasing, both as a result of in-migration to the state as well as a higher birth rate among those diverse individuals in the state of Minnesota. We're clearly behind the nation, but it's going to be a different Minnesota as we go forward than the Minnesota that we've known in the past.
And if you take this with the previous finding, if I recall correctly, that the diversity among the younger age groups will be increasing during that time period as well. So the diversity that the school system has to deal with will be a challenge for them as well. The next item is that public spending priorities will need to shift as Minnesota's economically dependent population grows larger and relies more heavily on fewer workers. That's kind of the duh follow-up to the previous slide.
And this is the key one. It's called the dependency ratio, and it really speaks to how many workers do we have to pay for those people that aren't working. And you can see that in 2000, we really reached a low point of the ages and youth in our society. And you can see by 2030, we're actually going to be to the point where there'll be less working people than there are people not working. And you can see the trend is going against us, and the impact, again, on tax revenue is going to be significant because workers tend to be the ones paying the taxes, not the young or the old.
And my additional guess on this is that the political pressures that will follow the increased dependency among people who are older on their working children and others will put additional political pressures on people to come up with programs to help alleviate those pressures. My guess, yeah.
Questions?
Yes, I think we've got Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You are looking at folks 64 and older as not working as an aggregate. Why did you come up with that assumption?
Well, it's a simple generalization. We don't expect that they're going to be working at the incomes that they were working at previous. Again, as a broad generalization. Also think out 20 years when those 62-year-olds are going to be 82 years old. That's really the other demographic thing that's occurring here is that people are living longer. So that our elderly will be living longer and oftentimes living on a fixed or a diminishing income.
And in addition to that, even the people that are on the, I'm speaking as now as a former Human Services Commissioner, but people who are dependent on state programs when they were young at younger ages because of disability, because of how good our health care is, they're living longer as well and experiencing the chronic diseases and the challenges of old age that they didn't experience previously.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. Just a follow-up. I'm not sure that I agree with the assumption that folks will be getting lesser salaries, maybe some, but I think we are projecting on what happened in the 50s and the 60s and what was an assumption that retirement was good and that folks maybe now aren't thinking the same way, particularly with the economic pressures to continue working until much, much later. And then we have some examples nationally of people who are working into their 80s and 90s, and Warren Buffett comes to mind.
Again, we were talking about the generalization. I think you can find all sorts of examples.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also your interpretation of the data. We had a interpretation of the data.
Excuse me, Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Chair. I guess so. Sort of on the same theme as Representative Wagenius, my question was just to clarify that there was a delineation made at age 65. correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, when we look at that inverse relationship, should that age be changed at some point, that obviously would change the dynamics of that relationship.
It potentially could. On the other hand, dependency is something beyond just reaching the age of 65. Dependency is where you're actually dependent on another taxpayer in that category. So, I mean, that's a different status than just reaching age 65. So you may have a concern or a question about one of the elements, one of the assumptions made in dealing with this, but the dependency factor still is there and is real.
All right, thank you.
Or is projected to be real, I should say. Everything that we're talking about are projections. Thank you.
Okay. You know, and I should just add maybe that last graph. Remember, a big part of that group who's dependent is youth. So you could probably play around with where the cutoff would be at those who are retiring, but I think you can look at that 2030 number and see how much of it is youth, and that's pretty well split. But members who don't serve on the tax committee may, you know, not think about it this way, but those who hear all from the tax committee know that because you retire doesn't mean you stop paying taxes. You just pay them at significantly lower rates. We have a broad definition of income in Minnesota that's not just payroll. It's a lot of things. But you actually not only pay them at lesser rates, you pay them lesser proportionately as you get older. So it is a problem no matter where you put the cutoff that receipts are going to diminish quickly when your population gets old and young, as you stated. So thank you, Representative. I missed it. Huntley, Representative Huntley.
Just a comment, Madam Chair, and that age 65 is when everybody gets eligible for Medicare. And whether you're working or not, it's Medicare that's paying a big chunk of your health bill. So age 65 is a key age, whether you're working or not.
All right. Thank you for that. Further questions on this item? Representative Downey.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question about the methodology. You talk about assumptions. Were those assumptions of the members of the committee, or were those assumptions based on real data and evidence?
This charter was provided by the state demographer, and we simply took data that was given to us that we found told the story that we saw unfolding and used these. So all these charts were produced by people that presented to the commission. In a couple instances, we asked for some additional information that resulted in the charts that we're using today. So this is all from the people from the administration providing this information.
And Representative Downey, I thank you for bringing that up because we've been remiss in not thanking the people who provided the commission with all the information, and that is Commissioner Hansen's office was staffed this commission. I know Commissioner Innes and the Department of Revenue was involved in this. I keep calling it the Department of Finance, but Hansen's is now Minnesota Management and Budget. And I know that Commissioner Segrin's group and the Department of Human Services, Department of Health, Higher Ed, and I believe just the legislative staff were the people who really did, let's be honest, the heavy lifting to get everything to these 15 people who are now recommending what they're recommending to us today. But we really need to thank them all. They worked really hard behind the scenes for a long time to provide the data so that people could make recommendations. So thank you for bringing that up.
And Madam Chair, they did clearly, without their support, we wouldn't have the product that we have today. We're still on the demographic findings number 3. Another chart.
Sorry. Okay. Minnesota high school graduation is declining in the U.S. and Minnesota while increasing in our competitor countries. What this is saying is that we look forward at the demographics. While we are going to have a growing number of young people, there is a trend that fewer of them are graduating from high school. And why that becomes critical is because, as we just looked at the prior chart, when you have more people not working than working, you want to have your workers be as advanced in their education as possible such that they can qualify for very good jobs. So one of the challenges here is making sure that we can increase the graduation rates back to former times in Minnesota, and do as well as other countries are doing with their graduation rates. On this particular one, What's happening is showing that the spending patterns, let's see, critical age shifts of school age and senior population beginning in 2008-11, and these will force changes in our spending priorities. We get into that in quite a bit of detail in a few minutes, in which human service costs and education costs are the fastest growing elements of the budget going forward, and they both exceed the rate of revenue growth. And one more.
And this chart just simply points out that the individuals aged 45 to 54 spend nearly half the amount of health care as those 55-64. So it goes to Representative Huntley's point that as the people get older, they still might be earning wages, but the cost related to health care will go up. All right. The next finding is, despite continuing to rank high among many key social and economic indicators, Minnesota's economy has underperformed recently relative to the nation. Accordingly, the governor and legislature should be conscious of assumptions regarding future economic growth when proposing budgetary changes.
Okay.
Representative Fulbert.
Chair, does the study commission ask the question of why that's happening? Why is Minnesota underperforming relative to the nation when we've had... So you never looked at the systemic reason of any recommendations of how we can change that trend?
We actually had quite a bit of discussion about whether it was sustained over a long enough period of time to actually call it a trend. I mean, we see it as something that's recent, and we had quite a discussion of how much should we focus on this? Is it really a trend? Is it something that the trend line is downward on it, or is it just an anomaly that we're seeing right now and we're coming out of it? And the people at the table, I think there's general agreement saying that they didn't feel that we have a long enough history to really say that it's a trend yet.
But it does bear watching. The most recent economic forecast indicated through the next biennium will still be lagging the U.S. economy in Minnesota, which is not the typical pattern, even in recession.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's the one statistic that probably bothers me the most of any of the statistics in our economy, particularly as it relates to the state. And the other one is the trend that we're having in personal income growth in the state of Minnesota as it relates to the rest of the nation. We're lagging and dropping rapidly on those two trends.
Yeah, it is possible that it's an anomaly with the way this recession occurred, with the drop in housing and the drop in the financial industry, that it may have impacted Minnesota more than it would normally. And so we want to see what happens as we come out of the recession, whether we come out faster than the nation, which has been our typical pattern.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, and another comment on what Representative Solberg asked. There was an article in the Regional Federal Reserve about 4 or 5 years ago, the journal that the local Federal Reserve puts out, and from 1960 to 2000, Minnesota had the fastest economic growth, median family wages of any state in the country. 1960, we were below average state. 2000, we were 6 or 7, depending on how you measure it. And no other state's come close to that growth. But since 2000, and Mr. Simpson will say 2002, I think, it's gone the other way, and we have not kept up. And as you said, is this a too short a time to tell? But it's certainly a dramatic change in what's happened in this state.
One of the conclusions that we drew from this finding was that it would be problematic if the legislature and the governor were to depend on the economy and the traditional strength of Minnesota's economy to solve the problems going forward. Doesn't mean we've got a worse problem. It's just there are enough questions to suggest that it's better not to presume that we're going to outperform to get us out of our problems.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Next finding is demographic and economic factors will lead to lower growth of state tax revenues over the next 25 years.
The Department of Finance at the beginning, and then the Department of Finance and Human Relations, or Human Relations, and now the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, did these projections for the first time out over 25 years, and what they in fact found was that our total growth in 2001 had been 6.8%, the five-year compounded growth rate. And as we looked out to 2033, we saw our revenue growth rate at 3.9%. So keep that 3.9% number in mind. Roughly 4% is what we see revenue growth occurring over the next 25 years. Again, lower than in the past, and that's important.
Captain Pulse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that an annual number or is that a biannual number?
It's an annual
annualized.
Number.
Yeah.
Annualized. So it's 4% per year, 8% for a biennial. Okay.
Next item, Minnesota has a long-term structural budget problem with long-term expenditure growth likely to outpace revenue growth.
What you see here is the 3.9% revenue growth, and all the way over to the right is the projection of spending over the next 25 years at an annual rate of 5.4%. In other words, we are projecting under current law that the state would be expending more than it would be taking in revenue. On a personal note, I think, or personally, I believe that we currently have a structural budget deficit, that if this was a normal economic year, we would have less revenue than we have in expenditures. It's very clear going forward, and the Commission concurs, that we have a structural budget problem going forward as well. And you can see it's being driven first by health care with an 8.5% annual increase. Not surprising to anybody that looks at health care premium increases that have been double digit, that we would be projecting faster growth than inflation. And then education has traditionally in Minnesota, and this is K-12 education, has grown faster than has its regular spending. The presumption for all other spending was 2.7%, and that's been the trend, and we projected that trend simply going forward to get to the 5.4% increase.
So just to restate, if we had a balanced budget in this biennium, just balanced, and but we had this current law, within the next biennium, based on these averages, we would still have expenditures exceeding revenues, and we'd have a budget problem in the next biennium. If you correct it again for that year, if those trends keep the same, you're going to have the problem next biennium as well.
And to underline that, I always just want to call you Representative, you know.
I've been called a lot of things, Madam Chair.
Well, when I was a freshman, you were a chair, and I think when you're a freshman, I always were kind of, wow, the chair of such and such, and that's still how I think of you today. I remember you taking on Senator Berglund and kind of watching all that. But to underline that, I think just to put it in context for members, when I introduced this bill, there was no deficit. So this slide is really not about our current problem. People should think that this product was being worked on this group long before we had a deficit. So this is more, you see through 2033. So kind of setting aside, this group didn't come together to solve our deficit. They came together to try to give us information long term. So Representative Liebling and Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify, when we're talking about the these deficits and so on, we're really just talking about the state's general fund, right? We're not...
Correct.
Are we in any way thinking about local governments and property taxes and any of that? How does that figure in?
Our charge was simply to look at the state. You'll see in a minute, we do talk about the property tax. It's the most stable of our tax sources, although the base may be going down this year for the first time in a long time. But no, we focused on state government, and the general fund was the particular focus.
Okay, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe you were just responding. I'm just looking at the legislative charge, and maybe there was just one way to approach this. But the dilemma for me in studying each slide is that I'm constantly feeling as though I'm reactive rather than proactive. In other words, we've begun to have some questions. You know, what are the characteristics of economically healthy states? How do we position ourselves for a prosperous future rather than reacting to statistics that we would ask why and change? I mean, it almost feels as though we're saying, okay, here are the demographics, and we live within those confines, and we have to make our adjustments. And from just starting a year like this, when you hope that you kind of break out of boxes and challenge yourself to think in a different way, there's a part of me that's having trouble getting in the right frame of mind to hear these slides. And I don't know whether we're getting to that later or... whether
I think the commission members found this information very sobering. We've had a tradition in Minnesota of optimism and forward thinking and innovation, and the commission got frustrated, I think, because there's a harsh reality that appears to be facing us, and there aren't easy solutions. I mean, it'd be nice if we had a recommendation that says we ought to grow the economy faster in Minnesota. Well, we ought to. But I don't think it's going to erase the problem you see in this particular slide. We have a structural imbalance, and it presumes we're going to grow like the nation. We could reduce that structural imbalance by economic growth, but other things need to be done.
And just to answer more specifically, Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, we are going through the findings right now. So these are the information that was given to us, and it's not only looking at the past, but looking out also into the future as to, if we don't do anything, what potentially or what most likely will it look like? We'll be following up with recommendations shortly, and we can talk about those as well. So there's, and you know, I also want to make a statement that in some communications and some discussions I've had with people, they think that the Budget Trends Commission would come up with the silver bullet to solve the $5 billion shortfall. No, there's no silver bullets out there. There's no easy choices. There's no easy ways out of these situations, and that wasn't our charge. But what we do have here, and I think when we get to the recommendations we can talk about that, is a management framework that will help legislators and state government avoid these situations in the future. If not completely avoid them, at least have tools in place so you can manage your way through them more easily. But there's always going to be challenges when you're when you're on that side of the table than on this side. And those are tough decisions sometimes.
To that point, did you want to follow up, Representative Hausman? No? Okay, Representative Rukavina and then Greiling.
I just wanted a clarification from Mr. Goodner Strelsky on when we're looking like on page 3 at the demographic findings and the spending projections, are we taking in the little Enron accounting procedure that we used in 2002 on the inflation on the revenue side and the spending side?
And Representative Rukavina, you're off mic, so I'll just... Representative Rukavina is wanting to know if inflation is being counted in there?
On the chart. Worse than it really looks if you include inflation into the...
There was an inflation factor built into both the revenues and the expenditures for purposes of this 25-year analysis.
Representative Rukavina?
No, so then we're looking at reality.
Yeah.
Well, it's our best estimate. It's the best estimate of the department's view of what the future would look like under current law.
Representative Rukavina?
Then current law doesn't let you account for inflation.
Current law, as it relates to the expenditures that were planned, in this projection, inflation was included on both the revenue and the expenditure side.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that this is, whether this was planned for the deficit or not, it's very timely and helpful and useful. And I just want to point out, though, a couple of things regarding education funding. As long as this only includes the state picture and not property taxes, we should all keep in mind that when we, in the Education Committee, when we include inflation, and things like debt service equalization and special ed costs and whatnot, that education has basically been flatlined. And the money that when we took over the property taxes was basically a wash for school districts. It wasn't new money at the state level, it's new money. And also we have the fastest growing part of our budget is special education, so it's very tied in with the comments on health care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Further questions? Representative Jesus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question in regards to this. You say that we have a structural deficit. Did this crystallize this year, or do you know when this started?
Mr. Sidrowski, can you please tell us who we can blame for this? It can't be anyone in this room.
The root cause of this is that Minnesota has a very volatile revenue system, and that the legislature and the governor over the last 30 years have struggled because in good times there's a tendency to want to believe that this is going to continue forever, and we tend to reduce taxes too much and increase spending too much. A specific example would be 1999's legislative session. Pam Wheelock was Commissioner of Finance, said there were boatloads of money. The legislature reduced taxes. The legislature increased expenditures. And I think that put us into a structural deficit. The commission hasn't said that. We didn't look at that specific. But I think that was the time period, plus the following year when we did the school aid change, that we put ourselves into a situation that in a normal economic condition, our revenues would not be enough to meet our expenditures. Then what happened was we went into a recession and we found, in fact, we had a large deficit. We recovered from that, and when we recovered, we had excess revenues that we thought, again, was telling us that we were in balance, but I think it was a false indicator. I think that we weren't structurally in balance, so I don't think we've been structurally in balance since 1999. And I'll again point out it was both the revenue changes and the expenditure changes that were made in 1999, because people want to blame one or the other. It was both of those, along with the school aid change in 2000, that really made the difference.
Representative Dietrich, follow up?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Further? Okay, thank
you. Nice segue to the next finding. Healthcare growth will become the most important factor in controlling rising state expenditures. It's self-explanatory. Your revenue growth is at 3.9% and your expenditure growth is at 8.5%. This is what's really contributing quite a bit to the disparity between the growth in revenues and expenditures. Go ahead.
In fact, we did find in the projection there was a point at which the only thing the state was spending money on was the public health care program. But it crowds out everything else if you take this out far enough.
But let me just emphasize a few different things. When you're looking at health care under public programs, it's not the same as the health care that you're getting from your employer. I mean, basically that's acute care. This includes Medicaid, includes general assistance general assistance medical care, Minnesota Care, and all those programs. Those programs tend, and the public programs tend to be the safety net for those that are most in need. So we're dealing with the most vulnerable people, the people that have the highest costs associated with care, and it includes more than just basic health care. For those that are severely disabled, people with developmental disabilities, mental health issues, autism, and other disabilities, it includes some other types of programs that are wrapped around those health care but are still paid for through medical assistance. And so when you look for somebody to blame under the previous question, back in 1999, I was the chair of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee that spent an awful lot of new money on programs for people with developmental disabilities. And so, but that was a choice that was made then based on the priorities that legislature had and that government had at that time and the pressures that the citizens felt at that point. We're at a different stage now and we need to look at where we're going, but that is what this number covers. And just addressing the issue of health care reform by itself in the big scope won't address this issue because of the needs that are there. Additionally, in addition to what I said previously, or just to reiterate what I said previously, and these people, these children, these adults are living longer. You know, a child that used to die at birth is living 20, 30 years. And the associated health care costs that go along with that and support services that go with that are increasing our costs. If you break down the 8.5%, at least from what I recall from a previous life, you can break it down into three categories. Increasing in healthcare inflation,
you can, it's also additional caseload, and it's also the people that are currently being served that their needs are higher, that their acuity levels are going up. And so it's a combination of those three things that are driving those costs. So. And if you want a dissertation on healthcare costs, we can, Representative Huntley and I could go on for a while.
Number eight.
State revenue volatility will make long-term budget instability more difficult to manage.
The finance department and the economist, the state economist and his staff did some new analyses for the commission. And what they looked at was the tax base volatility. And what they found, in fact, is that Minnesota has become 20% more volatile than it had been previously. If you go back a decade, we are now 20% more volatile, and that's because greater use of the income tax and the corporate income tax is driving that volatility.
And again, on the tax system, when we talk about the revenues not keeping pace with expenditures, it's just not enough to raise taxes, because if you raise it and balance it 1 year, then if you don't raise a tax or raise a revenue stream that increases, that has a higher growth rate than what you had previously, you're still structurally imbalanced. So if you look at the volatility, I mean, basically you have the three legs. You have the volatility, you have the growth rate, and then you also have the issue of progressivity. And you can address the growth rate issue and the stability, but you give up on progressivity. So that you can't, perfect world, you'd want all three. But this is all a balancing act on how you want your tax system to look like.
And I think that should be underlined. People often who will say, well, let's just change the system so it's not volatile, don't realize that means significant movement toward very regressive taxes, because we're relying on the income tax, which is making it volatile. And all those pieces are moving around together. And we'll get to the recommendations. For those who read ahead, it's kind of probably a better bang for your buck to just increase your reserve and worry so much about how to change all the tax system.
That is the recommendation of the commission.
And Madam Chair, if you look at the chart, you'll see that those tax bases that have the highest volatility also have the highest growth.
Yeah.
And so if you want to reduce or remove the volatility, you're removing the growth in it, and that then exacerbates your structural imbalance problem.
Right. Representative Solberg, and then...
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Kozlowski, you said big changes were made in 99 and 2000, and you referenced it again a decade ago. Did you do any analysis of what would have happened if we had not changed the tax structure of those, or where would we be now?
Madam Chairman, Representative, we did not.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because I heard on the radio that one of your recommendations is to make sure you have a long-term four-year type of budgeting, and we were doing that before that time under the leadership of Arne Carlson.
We were attempting to.
Attempting to, yes.
And in 99, it was the new administration, and they didn't, the economic projections at that time showed that life was going to be good forever. So that your projections out 4 years said there was no problem. And we'll get to that as one of our recommendations, because in fact, we four finance commissioners on this commission frankly came to the conclusion that we did a disservice to the state in good times by in essence saying things are going to continue to be good. So the decisions in 1999 were not irrational. They were just based on projections that couldn't be sustained.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, you had mentioned that recently the volatility of Minnesota's tax code has just become more volatile. Have there been any changes in public policy that have resulted in this, or what's the reason why this is happening?
There have been some, Mr. Chairman, Representative, there have been some small changes that have increased the volatility exemptions. And things like that can, in fact, increase the volatility. But it was also the fact that, as you can see here, the sales tax base is a little less volatile than the income tax base, and our sales tax wasn't keeping up because of internet sales and other things. so it wasn't growing as rapidly. So as the income tax became a greater share of our total revenues, the volatility increased. Okay. And to the extent, too, that we made commitments of our revenues to other units of government, that would also change the volatility. We need to keep moving here.
And the next one's with regard to the volatility. The system has become more volatile over the last 10 years.
And so anybody that wants to believe today it's going to continue as it is, just look at this chart. You notice it also goes up. As I've pointed out to other groups that are really depressed now with the state budget, that it's winter and spring does come every year in Minnesota, and we will also see a better economy at some point in Minnesota.
Next item is replacing highly volatile tax-based components with less volatile sources could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. Are we there? Oh, you've got more stuff. I'm sorry. I skipped way ahead.
I'm sorry. This just shows you the volatility of the taxes. Going to Kevin's point.
More volatility.
And actually, we don't have a slide for that one.
But there's a however in there. Such changes would also affect revenue growth rates and the distribution of the tax burden among taxpayers. We've already discussed
that. And again, we'll get to that in one of the recommendations.
Adjusting the mix of the current tax base while remaining revenue growth rate neutral cannot significantly reduce revenue volatility without a dramatic reweighting of tax revenue sources and a radical change in tax rates to the system.
This one is an interesting finding. I started my work on the commission believing that we could change the sales tax base and in fact reduce volatility substantially in Minnesota's tax system. I think it's fair to say that the commissioners got to the point that we no longer believe that. We didn't specifically run an analysis to prove that, so our recommendation falls short of saying don't expand the sales tax base to reduce volatility. But I think it's fair to say that the commission really doesn't believe extending the sales tax, for instance, to clothing and the personal services would have a dramatic impact in reducing volatility. It would have a similar volatility. You'd simply be taxing people differently.
And there was a lot of time spent by the
economists
on the economists opining about this one. So a lot of time.
Representative Solberg.
Did you say they were complaining about this?
Opining.
Sharing their opinion.
Opining.
Not whining, wow. Opining.
It's a variation of the word, I believe.
Thinking about it.
We spent 2 weeks of December and January in emails between the economists sorting through this language to get it as precise as it is. So if it's not understandable, you can understand why.
Representative Solberg. I assume then sales tax on food was off the table beginning. Because those states that do that have a lot less volatility.
In the sales tax base, that's correct. One of the things we did for the first time was look at the interaction of the taxes as it relates to volatility. Because sometimes increasing volatility of a given tax source might offset volatility in another of the tax sources. So we're looking at the total volatility, and that's why we can't flat-footedly say that changing the sales tax base will do X, Y, or Z, because we didn't do the analysis with the other taxes to make that determination. It could be done by the department, but frankly, they've got a lot of other things they're working on right now.
And there's been a lot of discussion for years. I mean, Governor Ventura, you know, could we expand the sales tax base and lower the rate? And I think the way I hear your finding here, it doesn't mean that folks who are still interested in that should reject it. There may be good tax reasons to do it, either incidents as you change the incidence of the sales tax because you bring in professionals, other services, or growth as the economy recovers. But volatility would not be solved through that. So those who are promoting that may continue to, but there's I think the finding is that it won't fix volatility. Right. It may do other good, heavy redeeming values.
But just don't do it believing you're going to solve the volatility problem.
Thank you.
Number 12, yep. Shifting consumption patterns have reduced Minnesota's sales tax base. We
don't have any mentioned
that briefly.
No pretty pictures.
13, Minnesota's statutory budget reserve ceiling has not grown to an appropriate level to adequately manage the underlying risks in Minnesota's tax system over time.
We had a fun moment in the commission when somebody asked Where did the notion about a 5% budget reserve come from? And I had to admit that it was Gus Donahoe in 1983, as we were suffering through the recession of the early 80s, simply picked it out of the air and said, we need a 5% budget reserve. Frankly, it was based on what we thought we could get out of the legislature at that time. That stuck for the next 30 years. And so we got to the point of realizing that we needed to do some analysis. And in fact, the finance staff did the analysis, and we now statistically can tell you, and we will in a moment, what the size of the budget reserve has to be. And in fact,
Representative Rugavina,
kind of to that point, Mr. Kudrowski, so now that we know where the 5% came from, can you tell us where, because I've heard the story where the 3% came from for the
actually
dealing on bonding that Governor Burson put in? Was it in an airport in New York? Were you with him?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I had Jim Scholl, Walter, the State Budget Director, come and speak to my class last spring, and it was on the capital budget, and he indicated to the class that my name was associated with creating the 3% guideline.
No, I never, but you were wrong.
I don't recall exactly how that occurred, but we do need a debt guideline in the state. 3% is not an unreasonable guideline, but it is a guideline.
I'm sure we answered the question.
A lot of us have played representatives.
The commission made no finding on that.
Correct. What the commission did find was that statistically, if you want to have a stable budget situation for 4 years or two biennia, you need to set aside $2 billion to $2.3 billion in a budget reserve to manage the situation with the budget reserve. And that presumes that at the beginning of the biennium, you've got that money, and it presumes that you replenish it as you go along during that time period.
And that you start with the balanced budget at the beginning.
Right.
The balance at the end of the season.
And the budget's balanced for the next two biennia, and you need $2 billion to $2.3 billion in the bank.
And that's based on a 1 in 20 year scenario.
It's 95% probability that you would cover the deficit.
Madam Chair,
Representative Eastland.
And that's assuming we have roughly a $34 billion budget. Is that
correct?
So, okay.
Correct.
Thank you. President Fulver.
Madam Chair, if we had $2 billion and took it out of the economy, out of people's taxpayers' pocketbook right now, and or even if we had done that in the past, wouldn't it be better to have them in their pocketbook? And, I mean, we may feel good as a state because we've got a big reserve, but wouldn't it be better to have some kind of a tax policy that if we need the money, we take it then, instead of taking it in advance and putting it in our bank so we feel better?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, you've touched on a very sensitive point to me, having served in local government and state government in the state of Minnesota and having watched this over the last 30 years. Deficits are destructive to good government. It is very hard for local officials to operate effectively and efficiently when they don't know how much money they're going to be getting in. And I would take as an example budget cuts that just occurred in December with days left in the fiscal year when governmental entities had to cut money in order to balance their budgets for the end of the year. Maybe that's a personal opinion, but I think it is likely to be true that a more stable financial system at the state of Minnesota would make for more efficient and effective government throughout the state of Minnesota because you'd have consistency. I think it's prudent to build up budget reserves when the state has money. I think our as I read the paper this morning from our press briefing yesterday, I think there was a little misconception. We're not suggesting to you today that you set aside an additional $2 billion in addition to solving the budget problem this year. We do think, though, that you need to set that as the target for the budget reserve if you want to get out of this roller coaster and this rapidly rising and falling roller coaster of fiscal deficits and surpluses in Minnesota. You need to set that as the goal. and any new dollars coming in the future need to go to setting up and funding that reserve.
And, you know, the commission recognizes, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that, you know, we're laying out here some options, and we recognize that there are public policy decisions that need to be made by the legislature. We are going to be putting, and we'll be getting the recommendations shortly, forward a number of recommendations that we think will help the legislature and future administrations manage situations that you're facing right now. How you want to exercise and move forward with those recommendations, that's entirely up to you. Maybe your risk is a 10% factor rather than a 5%. You know, you can modify that. Maybe you only need to get through a 2-year cycle rather than a 4-year cycle. But those are decisions that need to be made. We just felt it was important to lay that on the table and make those recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Kondrowski, what kind of tax volatility assumptions are these recommendations relying on? Is that the current degree of volatility?
So it'd be the current statute as it relates to all of the tax sources.
And if I could, a quick follow-on then. I just want to make sure I clarify. We made a comment that the movement of tax revenue proportionally to sales tax on commodities like food and clothing, while it would perhaps decrease volatility, you said it wouldn't guarantee that because of other offsetting kind of counter-cyclical volatilities in other tax sources. But I think we maybe came out with the assumption that moving to those tax sources would not decrease volatility, and I want to make sure that I understand whether or not you know that for a fact or whether that's something that you just didn't explore fully as a commission.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to be absolutely clear, we did not do the full analysis to be able to tell you statistically how accurate the statement is. I think the commission as a whole felt comfortable in realizing that you're not going to solve the state's budget volatility by extending the sales tax to additional items. But you're correct. We did not finish the statistical analysis. We ran out of time.
And I just want to add on that, and I know we all want to get to the findings, but there's so much on the sales tax debate. Really, the big debate within expanding the sales tax debate isn't so much about putting more commodities on the sales tax, because that's kind of what we're taxing. It's services. And that's the part of the economy we're not taxing. So people get off on clothing or fuels or food, and those bring in, you know, the regressivity question. But it's the fact that we're mostly not taxing services. That's the part of the economy that we're all purchasing, and we actually purchase it in greater amounts as we get older. Think healthcare services. And we don't tax that. So that's the part. And then you hear people talk about taxing the internet, and that's another subset part of it, but that's a federal issue. So, you know, when you think about, would you ever want to get the political will together around here with Democrats, Republicans, and the governor to change the sales tax base, it's really the big complication comes in how do you rope in the services rather than selecting through the menu of the commodities. And so that, again, would not, it appears, to not address volatility too much, but would achieve some other objectives in the tax code. So, Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I want to go back to the reserve for a moment, and over the years we've had a debate in terms of what should be counted in the reserve. You know, for example, there's the state reserve, but then we all know that school districts maintain a reserve, local units of government maintain a reserve, U of M, MNSCU, to name a few. How would you, either of you, define what we should count as a reserve from our perspective? And then the other point is that at times there's been discussion about what we need for reserve at the beginning of a biennium and what may be needed the second year or when you get close to the end of the biennium when we're calculating our expenditures.
Okay, thank you. You said I could go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the commission really didn't get into the details the commission's thought is that the reserve should be those reserves that the state, the legislature, that the governor has access to in dealing with the budget situation. The whole idea behind the reserve is not to take away the responsibility from the decision makers for making needed changes in the way expenditures or taxes are heading and doing we don't want you to avoid the corrective actions that are necessary, but we want to make sure that there's enough of the reserve in place to allow you to make corrective changes and then also preserve needed programs as you're going forward and allow you to get through these economic ups and downs that you will always see. You know, we've reached the conclusion that we can only marginally impact the volatility of the tax system. If you don't do that, then we need to figure out how do you manage that volatility more effectively than you are currently. And so, what I think we're looking at, the assumption was that we'd be looking at those resources that are available to the state and not looking at those other pockets of money that are out there. And the other issue, I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Well, do you need, we've debated at times what you may need at the beginning of the biennium and what you may need at the end of the biennium if your expenditures are...
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, that was part of our discussion about should we look at a four-year reserve account, a two-year reserve account. I always found it frustrating both as commissioner and as an elected official that we would be asked to, we have a budget reserve there for a time when you had an economic challenge, but then you also had to replenish it at the same time you're trying to balance your budget. And so, you know, I think there may be needed to be a discussion about that exact point. We did not identify what the minimal amount in the reserve should be, but I do think that if there's some other reasons to have a budget reserve other than getting you through those difficult times, you need to identify that and say, and maybe set it up as a separate account that's just untouchable, make it part of your cash flow account. Because in my mind, if you have a budget reserve, you should be able to use it at times like this. Well, you don't have one yet anymore, but I mean, well, you did.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, to your latter question, the more important factor is whether the following biennial budget projection is balanced. You have less need for a budget reserve if you can see out that following biennium to see that your revenues and expenditures are balanced. To the extent that they're not, you need a budget reserve to take care of the problem. As you look out, our assumption was is that you continually would be replenishing the budget reserve to the recommended levels over time. As it relates to your first question, it's a complicated and difficult question. At one extreme, you have local government that frankly doesn't have as much interaction with the state in terms of funding. Yes, you have Minneapolis and St. Paul that get a lot of local government aids, but other communities don't. And so it's hard for the state to frankly call those city reserves state reserves. And it's hard for the state to say we should take that money in tough times. At the other extreme, you have school districts where the state has such a interaction with schools, and you try to manage schools almost from St. Paul, it's more logical for you to suggest that some of those reserves are more like state reserves. My opinion is you'd be far better served to truly make local government, force them to operate more on their own, force them to manage their reserves, and for the state to take care of its responsibility in managing its budget and making consistent the payments it makes to local government.
One of the reasons I raised the question, you won't need to respond because we're running out of time, but Austin and I have talked to representatives of the higher ed institutions or school districts. They will justify basically two reasons for their reserve. One, cash flow. And the other is, well, we can't rely on the state. And
right.
Therefore, that comment kind of implies that they're part of our reserve in a sense, because if we can't make the payments as promised, they will use that reserve and that case to back it up, at least for that biennium. But you don't need to comment other than that's the kind of discussion we sometimes have with local officials and others.
Thank you. And we do want to get to the recommendations because we are going to adjourn on time. We've got Representative Mullery, and then the last finding, and then we'll get to recommendations.
Oh.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I was just going to point out when you were talking about the sales tax extension, and you were talking about the regressivity, there was, I remember at the time of the extending to services, there was just as much of a problem with regressivity there, too.
Yeah.
The way you said it, you didn't say that, but it implied that.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay, so last finding and then recommendations.
Madam Chair, the last finding is that Minnesota needs a cash flow reserve account of sufficient size so that the state can avoid short-term external borrowing during a biennium. This is tied to a finding that we have, and we can
I think this is pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, frankly, this is going to be your most difficult challenge this legislative session, is to ensure that you have sufficient cash flow reserve, and the department will be, as part of the governor's budget recommendation, indicating to you what the size of the cash flow reserve needs to be. We've used a number traditionally. Again, that was just pulled out of the air. They're going to actually be calculating what's necessary under the governor's budget to avoid short-term external borrowing. If we go to the recommendations, there are really three categories. First one is provide decision makers and citizens with necessary information to make informed budget and policy decisions. And under that, the first recommendation is create a permanent long-range planning function in state government. That was in the Carlson Report of 1992. We found in doing this work that it's work that should be on an ongoing basis, and it was being done for the first time. The state should be regularly doing 25-year financial projections. It should regularly having an interaction between the demographer and the finance people as it looks forward. So that, we think, is important. Again, Kevin, jump in here when you need to say something. Release the demographic forecast in the start of each biennium. We were overwhelmed, frankly, by some of the demographic findings, and we want to give higher notoriety to those findings, so we're suggesting that as the state biennial forecast is done, in as it was this year in December prior to the legislative session, that we have an equally visible demographic forecast of what Minnesota looks like going forward, so that you can use those, both of those factors in thinking about the future. You can see that this is our one part of the report where there was a disagreement. The commission overall found that, or recommends that, the financial forecast should be based on current law, and inflation or deflation of both revenues and expenditures should be included to provide an accurate planning perspective, but in fact you should I don't have the full recommendation in here, but it says that you should, for budget purposes, decide on whether you want to include inflation or not. We separated the planning projections from, in fact, the budgeting process. And that was the recommendation of the Carlson Report, as well as the 1986 Finance Department Report. Former Representative Jim Knobloch disagreed with that, but did support the overall report with this minority statement on this particular recommendation.
And I just need to note, we spent a good portion of one meeting discussing this among the members, and I would say that after we got done with it, I think everybody appreciated the fact that they learned something about the discussion and about the perspectives on this issue. But I think Art Rolnick probably said it best, saying that, you know, my preference is to include it in, but in the big scheme of things and what we're dealing with here, it's really not a big deal. It's a minor point on with regard to everything else that we were doing. So as much as attention has been focused on this, from the commission's perspective, it's not that big a deal in what we're recommending here.
The next set of recommendations related to long-term balance of state revenues and expenditure. The first one was to minimize tax exemption deductions and credits unless necessary for federal conformity, and the reason for that is they tend to increase the volatility to the extent that you do that, at least without thinking about the volatility impact that they might have. And that was a Department of Revenue recommendation from 92. The next recommendation is to help the governor and legislature manage long-term obligations. The state should begin by spending no more in the current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. The last legislative session, when this legislative session, you're going to have difficulty doing this. It's something that you need to do ongoing. It avoids you from creating your own problems. As an example, when you left St. Paul last year, there was $1 billion of imbalance in the 10-11 biennial forecast that you didn't resolve as you looked at resolving last year's budget situation. So part of this year's deficit was part of what you left undone last session. Any additional one-time revenue should be used strictly for building reserves, paying off ships, capital projects, and other one-time purposes. in essence, what we're saying is, and you'll see in a moment, if you've balanced your ongoing revenue with your ongoing expenditures and new money comes in, the worst thing that you can do is make a permanent change because you don't know where you are in the economic cycle. If you're at the point where you're about to go into recession, you will have built the deficit larger by doing something on an ongoing basis. So we're suggesting that when you do have excess money, that you use it for one-time only items until you're confident that, in fact, on the long term, you've got greater revenues than you have expenditures. The last set of, expenditure forecasts include information about rates of growth of expenditure areas. I think if you look at the rates of growth, you'll see, as we found looking at the future, that the health and human services area is the most rapidly growing, with K-12 being the second most rapidly growing. The governor and legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. I can't emphasize this enough. When I was Commissioner of Finance, we started this tradition of looking out. We wanted to eliminate tails that were being created by people putting in one quarter of the biennium expenditure items that would have three times the impact in the following biennium, or in fact putting in a tax decrease in the later part of the biennium that would have twice as much impact the following biennium. You need to be looking at that following biennium to understand what you're doing and the impact you're going to have. When making budgetary decisions to achieve a balance of expenditures and revenues, the governor and legislature should consider the impact of shifting the expenditure burden to the private sector or local units of government. This is precisely the point that was being raised earlier about the impact that we could have in budget decisions of the legislature on local property taxes, on the stability of local governments. The legislature needs to be cognizant of what impacts it might have on not only local units of government, but also the private sector, as you're making budget decisions.
One of the most difficult things that we dealt with was the whole issue of what do you do about health care costs. I think that's enough. And the best we could come up with the folks that we had at the table in the short period of time we had was to create a long-term public-private group with responsibility to annually recommend policy changes for better control of the costs and making recommendations on how to manage the system. It's not an ideal solution, and I'm always suspect of groups being appointed and, you know, and not really having a good product come through, but we really do need to get a handle on it. The health Medicaid area is very siloed. One of the biggest challenges in really accomplishing and addressing those issues are a lot of the regulations and restrictions that the federal government puts on you as a state. So it's really a big challenge, but we needed to have a recommendation on health care in here. This is the best we could come up with, and we know there are better solutions than this, and we would welcome any ideas that any of you would have and how we can move that forward. So.
Address the education attainment gaps in the current K-12 system, because that was a finding we
realized. Just to that point, and we are going to try to get through all your recommendations, and Representative Garofalo has a question too, but Representative Huntley wants to respond to.
Well, we had a group 2 years ago. It was a public-private group that made some recommendations to the governor and to the legislature, and that would have saved 20% of healthcare spending. But the governor and the legislators wimped out and wouldn't implement the recommended policy. So I'm not, you're absolutely right about the problem with outside groups making recommendations to the legislature. But I will say that I always like to quote Republicans and former Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill, who knows a little bit about health care, says that half the money we spend in health care is wasted. And so there's plenty of opportunity in there to save money.
And Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, and I think we recognize that within the commission. I do also want to reemphasize that the Medicaid budget, medical assistance budget in Minnesota, goes beyond just the acute care.
Yeah.
So, and that has to be addressed as well.
You talked about education, the attainment gap. Minnesota collectively needs to address that problem going forward. Managing state budget volatility. I think for the commissioners of finance at the table, this was the most significant recommendation. we came to the conclusion that we did some harm to state finances over our 10 years unknowingly, because in good times we consistently said they were going to stay good times. That's the way the forecast worked. It was always the consensus of Global Insights, and up until last spring they had consistently always said there wouldn't be a recession in the time horizon. What we're saying is that in the future, when we do have good times, we should not falsely believe that those exuberant good times are going to continue. Rather, we should use the trend line of growth over the long term as the basis for the economic forecast, not that inflated number that comes from Global Insights.
So just to clarify for members, because this is an important part, is in a big change, is that rather than getting the forecast based on the current economic situation, which may be up and may be down, that we also look at the long-term trend line with regard to those elements as well. And if the economic, you know, growth is up here and the trend line is here, that you don't spend the difference between the trend line and the what your current projection is. You put that aside as one-time spending, but you only spend it at the level. Well, there's more to that.
Yeah, but 1999 would be the example in which we over-forecasted revenues, and by 2002 we are seeing the impact of having done that in a negative way. So trend line would have reduced the amount we would have reduced taxes or increased spending. Permanent tax reduction or expenditure increase should only be undertaken under certain circumstances, a recommendation from the Department of Revenue report in 1992, and that's frankly that you can project that they're going to be payable, or you're going to be able to finance them over the long term. The Minnesota management and budget should determine the size of the budget reserve necessary for the volatility of the state. We've now established a process and a formula for doing that. That's consistent with prior reports. Given the current size of the state budget, we recommend a $2.1 billion budget reserve. If you want it for 4 years, if you want it for a two-year period, it would be $1.6 billion. That's what's currently calculated. That number will increase over time as the size of the budget will increase, and there's now a formula for determining that. It's our hope that, frankly, these recommendations be put into legislation and passed this session. It's not going to solve the current problem. There's nothing in this report that's going to help you with the $4+, $5+ billion problem you're facing. But, frankly, you're going to be facing this problem 3 or 4 years from now after we come out of the recovery and have the next recession, unless you plant this corn seeds today. You then will avoid that next time. And frankly, for some of the legislators that I've talked to that have been around 20 and 30 years, that's what they desperately want, is not to have this occur again. As we suggested, the budget reserve is depleted in the current biennium. It should be replaced in two biennia, and then the cash flow account should be maintained separate from the budget reserve to avoid the short-term external borrowing.
And that's a key recommendation, because what's kept us, I mean, right now we have a good cash flow account balance, and that's helped us get through this tough economic times without having to, unlike California, where we're saying, gee, we're out of money, we need help. One thing we do is we borrow internally from other funds in order to manage cash flow. And so to the extent that those funds are depleted in any budget solution, that will increase the need for a higher cash flow account number. And so that's why it's important to have MMB forecast the needed cash flow account in order to avoid that short-term external borrowing.
This is the third commission that I've now served on over my 30 years of on and off involvement in state government.
Hopefully you get it right this time.
Yeah. Or hopefully the legislature and the governor implement the recommendations. I say that because, you know, yesterday when we met with the media, they kept saying, well, what's new? What's the big deal? What do you recommend? We don't understand. The beauty of this is that it's all in the fundamentals. In football terminology, it's the blocking and the tackling. It's in the pits where this needs to occur. The solutions you've known about There hasn't been the public will to implement these when times were good because there were pressures to spend money and reduce taxes. This is absolutely the right time to put in place this set of recommendations to legislate this now because you don't have that pressure. This doesn't cost you anything, but in fact it will build the, it's the building blocks of the foundation that will prevent future legislators from going through what you're going through this year. And that's the greatest hope of the commission is that this, our set of recommendations would be adopted such that we could avoid having another commission analyze why the state's having financial problems 4 or 5 years from now, because I'd prefer not to serve on it, frankly.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo, then Hausman and Fulton. Nope, I'm Representative Hausman. Representative Garofalo passed.
Isn't this ultimately, though, going to change with every governor? I recall, because I think my constituent was in that office, we had an office of planning not too long ago. And not too long ago, that office was done away with, and that function was pulled into the governor's office. And that, and so you might make recommendations to a legislature, and one could even enact, but it seems to me the nature of governance is such that every administrator brings their mark, and that it only lasts as long as an administration. Where am I wrong? I just remember just one of your recommendations of the Office of Planning, which we had, and now we don't.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, we think there needs to be planning functions, and I think Department of MMB does a number of planning functions. I would have to say that I think there are planning tools. The state could use a lot better planning tools in how they're projecting their budget growth and how they're looking at demographic trends and other types of elements. It doesn't have to be a separate budget planning office in any one place, but the state has to look at that because with the changing demographics, you need to get a better handle on that, and you need to be better able to look at what you'll be facing in the future so you can address it more quickly rather than dealing with it when you have a crisis. But the reality of this is these recommendations don't mean anything unless there's a will to enact the recommendations and put it into structure in place, and then there's the courage and the discipline to actually follow through on those recommendations after those they're put into statute. And, you know, you have the will, you have the ability to change those statutes every year. You know, so, but it's, you know, and that's part of our process, and that's just reality. And so I guess it's up to you to decide, is there a will here to do that or not? And then it's up to later governors and elected officials to follow through on it.
Representative Fulber.
Madam Chair, I just have an observation, and Mr. Goodnew kind of said the same thing. We've got findings on revenue and expenditures that we need to pay attention to. But I think the most important thing we need to be looking at is the demographics, the findings of the demographics. That's not a question, that's just an observation.
Thank you. And I think Chair Carlson and I both want to say thank you to both of you so very much for coming and for the report, and we will get at it. So thank you very much.
We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.